third case for today, 99-2466, Richard Ahrens versus Town of Fulton. And we'll be hearing from Russell W. DeBitt, representing Richard Ahrens. Counsel?
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court. My name is Russell DeBitt, and I'm privileged to represent the plaintiffs, Mr. and Mrs. Ahrens, and approximately 136 other residents of Wisconsin's Rock River Leisure Estates. You've read the briefs, I'm sure. You're aware that this case involves the construction of Wisconsin Statute Section 70.043, which relates to mobile homes, and as it interrelates with Statute 70.111, paren 19, which relates to exemptions for certain smaller recreational mobile homes. The Court of Appeals in this case, we submit, erred in its determination as to what the wording of 70.043 meant. 70.043 says that a mobile home is an improvement to real property if it is set upon a foundation and if it's off its wheels and set on some other system. We contend that that is not the circumstance with respect to these particular plaintiffs' recreational vehicles. As you know from reading the briefs, all of our clients have the smaller recreational vehicle mobile homes, which are referred to in 70.111 paren 19 with a few exceptions. We contend that the homes that our clients have are, as I say, none of those things. The test that the majority in the Court of Appeals supplied was that in order to meet the definition of personal property, these vehicles had to have all of their weight on their wheels, period. They could have no weight on anything else. That was an easy test, and they felt that that would be something that the assessor could figure out, bend over, look under the thing, and see whether it had its wheels on the ground or didn't have its wheels on the ground. The statute uses the word foundation. It says set on a foundation. Foundation is actually a defined term in the Wisconsin tax, property tax assessment manual. It's defined at page 21.7-24. Defines it as the base upon which something rests, the supporting part of the wall, house, etc., usually of masonry, concrete, and at least partially underground. You know from reading the facts in this case that none of these cinder blocks or stabilizers used in this case are anywhere close to being underground. So the statute uses the term improvement. The Court of Appeals used as a resource to define several other terms, Webster's New World Dictionary, Second College Edition. Court did not choose to define improvement. Improvement is defined in that same edition, in pertinent part, as a change or addition to land or real property, such as a sewer, fence, etc., to make it more valuable, to make the land more valuable. That's not what we have in this case. What we have here are units which are less than 400 square feet, as I said, general. There are a few exceptions. All with wheels and a chassis, all with vehicle identification numbers. 15 of the 20 of them have current motor vehicle licenses. It's been stipulated as one of the facts that all of them can be removed, almost all of them can be removed from the premises in less than 2 hours. That's an improvement. That's not an improvement to real estate, we submit. Furthermore, in the real estate tax assessment manual, when it's directing its appraisers to consider mobile homes and whether they constitute realty, at section 15.6, entitled Real Property versus Personal Property Classification Guide, indicate in a table that's attached for easy reference that a mobile home is real property if it's on a permanent foundation on the owner's lot connected to utilities. These are not on a permanent foundation. is our cinder blocks or stabilizers that are placed under it so that in a strong wind it doesn't tip. And that shouldn't be surprising with a unit of this size. We're talking about something that's 400 square feet. It may be 10 by 40. It's a large unit. That doesn't make an improvement to real estate.
I wonder if you could help me by telling me what the differences are among all of the people that have touched, all the people or entities that have touched the case. Now, the trial court said they all have tests for what's real property, right?
Yeah.
They each have, everyone has had a test for what is real property, right? So under the trial court, see if I understand it, is real, it's real property if the majority of weight is borne by something other than the wheels. Is that the trial court's view?
Right.
All right. Is that your view?
No.
Okay. What is your view? As I have it, it's that real, it is real property if the wheels have been removed or the entire weight is on something other than the wheels. Is that your test?
My test for it being personal property or real property?
For real property.
My test for it, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Wheels, if the wheels are off the ground, it's also real property.
Pardon me?
If the wheels are off the ground, it's also real property.
Okay.
It does not have to have wheels removed.
Wheels off the ground. All right. And what the Court of Appeals' position is that it's real property if any weight is borne by something other than wheels, right?
Right.
All right. And the town's position is it's real property if any weight is on something other than the wheels.
Right.
So the town seems to agree with the Court of Appeals. Is that right?
Yes.
And you don't agree with the trial court.
Your Honor, I believe the trial court is closer than the Court of Appeals, but I do not agree. I think that because the Court of Appeals stressed the ease of the test as to the trial court, that an easier test is to determine whether the wheels are on the ground at all.
And what's Judge Dykeman's test? Is that your test?
Judge Dykeman's test is that if the wheels are on the ground at all, or one of the wheels are on the ground, then it's not off its wheels, and therefore it is not real property.
It's not real property if what?
If the wheels are on the ground. If there's any weight at all on the wheels, it is not real property.
What makes it real property then? I put all these into the positive, what is real property, so I can compare them. It doesn't help me when we say what is or isn't. You know what I'm trying to say?
While the wheels are off the ground, we contend that it's real property according to the definition here stated, and if it's set on some other support.
And if it, counsel, so that the wheels they're looking at, that you have the rims, and then you have the rubber tires. Now, I'm just asking, these would, the wheels would be the rubber tires, or is it just the rims? Because sometimes you have the, you know, the tires are off and the rims are sitting there, and is that with cinder blocks under them? But you're talking about where the rim or the tire, rubber tire or the steel rim, would be off the ground.
Where the rubber meets the earth.
Well, assuming it's rubber, so you're saying that if the rubber tire is off, there's no wheel, in other words.
That's correct.
Yeah.
We do not see that it would be bearing weight on its wheels if the rubber tire is off.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
The record demonstrates that these vehicles are brought to the sites on which they are located. They are not jacked up. Affidavit indicates they are not jacked up and placed on something. On site, there are some cinder blocks, some cement blocks that are stuck underneath just to act as a stabilizer, and that 90% of the weight of the vehicle is resting on wheels, not on blocks. The blocks are merely acting as a stabilizer.
They're merely what?
Acting as a stabilizer.
counsel, does it matter for real property purposes analysis whether or not the mobile home is over the 400 or above the 400 feet for real property purposes?
No. That only matters with respect to the exemption for the recreational vehicles that we're claiming on behalf of our client. And that's an important distinction.
The reason I ask, and I need help on this, it seems to me that the Court of Appeals opinion might include as part of its analysis on the issue of whether this constitutes real property the discussion of whether it's 400 above or below 400 feet. And it seemed to me that that wasn't part of the analysis for real property. In fact, I think that that section is entitled personal property. It's exemption or something like that. Can you help me with that? Did the Court of Appeals make a mistake in including the personal property exemption discussion in its analysis of real property?
I think it's somewhat confusing initially. 7043 defines all mobile homes that exist in the state of Wisconsin.
Counsel, I'm sorry. If you could just speak up. I'm having difficulty hearing.
I'm sure. 7043, defining mobile homes, is a definition of all mobile homes that exist anywhere in the state of Wisconsin, whether they be 1,400 square feet or 400 square feet. It has nothing to do with an exemption, and it has to do, and that statute indicates that any of these homes anywhere in the state, unless they're in a mobile home park subject to a parking fee, are defined as real property if they're on a foundation, as you often see larger mobile homes sitting on a concrete foundation, not at all uncommon. Or if they are not on a foundation, they're taxed as personal property, but none of those over 400 are exempt. The only exemption is under 70.111, Red 19.
Okay, so I hear your answer. Let me see if I understand it. Do I understand then that the exemptions set forth in 70.111, which include the exemption for mobile homes that are no larger than 400 square feet, that analysis applies to an exemption for personal property, not and does not belong in the analysis as to whether or not it may be taxed as real property.
Right. Right. In fact, that's our primary contention in this lawsuit, that if you abrogate, that by virtue of the majority opinion, you've essentially abrogated the exemption, because if you define these as real property, they're no longer eligible for the personal property exemption. Consequently, if the majority test is followed, all recreational vehicles in Wisconsin that are less than 400 square feet that are located anywhere on land owned by their owner, assuming they're connected to utilities, will be, and the weight is not entirely on the wheels. Suppose the tongue is down, the weight won't be entirely on the wheels. They'll all be considered improvements to real property. And what that does, and that, and our argument is what that does, it absolutely abrogates an exemption which the legislature created specifically for these. And not only did it create it specifically for these, but as you know, the legislature clarified, so-called clarified, 7043 in 1983. In 1991, the legislature again revisited the issue of exemptions for these recreational vehicles. Current 70111, Rent 19, was passed effective 1991. Not only did they restate the exemption, they increased it. It was prior to that 280 square feet, not used for residential purposes. In 1991, in full light of the clarification of 70043, they increased it to 400 square feet, used as temporary or seasonal residential purposes.
Of 139 owners, how many are more than 400 square feet?
Sorry, Judge.
Of the 139 owners that are involved in this case, how many of them are more than 400 square feet?
Of the representative plaintiffs,
okay,
there's about
the 20, that are more than 400
square feet, correct. They would not be eligible for the personal property tax exemption.
Say that again more slowly, please. They were not...
They would not be eligible for the personal property tax exemption.
Well, is it your position, then, that if you can make them not real estate, not real property, then they will be exempt from personal property? Is that it?
If the definition we think is as the legislature intended would allow a determination if their tax is personal property, that would allow them to come to the Board of Review to state their position regarding whether they meet the criteria of 71.1.1.19, which are less than 400 square feet or less, used for seasonal living purposes.
Well, if I understand the Court of Appeals decision, they thought that it really didn't make much difference whether it was taxed as real or personal property.
That's
and
correct.
It's part of your brief is that it does matter because they're different procedures.
Correct, Justice. Not only that, the property tax assessment manual, the reason I keep quoting is because it's quoted heavily in the town's brief, makes distinctions, specific distinctions between real property and personal property. It sets forth five different reasons why it's important for the assessor to distinguish between personal property and real property. On page 21.7-23, excuse me, that's the wrong page, it's on page 21.5.1. The five reasons include...
I must be a little, I had too much to eat or something. You got to slow down for me now. What, you're citing to what? 21?
Citation to the tax assessment manual is 21.5-1. And it indicates that there are five specific reasons why it's important to distinguish between these. The first one is the one that's before the court today. It may determine assessability. The second is to determine on which roll the property should be listed. The third is it may affect to whom the property is assessed. The fourth is that there are different permissible dates for payment of the tax. Personal property tax is paid earlier. Real estate taxes are paid potentially in installments. Fifth, there are different procedures for the collection of the tax. Personal property tax is not subject to the lien of the real estate. Real estate taxes are. Conceivably, that's one of the reasons that that this is chosen to be taxed as real property as opposed to personal property, because they don't want the property owner to escape and not have to pay the taxes on the personal property. There's some language in the Legislative Council note that they thought that way at least there'd be enough value in the real estate to cover the tax if the owner got out of town, which is a pretty absurd, but it's nonetheless was what it's stated. Especially is it absurd in the case of these people because they all own the lots on which they're located. So if they left, they'd be leaving their lots. That's not the only reason that that distinction is an important distinction, but those are the distinctions that are made here. We consider the most important of those the fact that it does drastically affect accessibility. Because, as we stated, if they're classified as real property, then a great deal of what the legislature intended would be exempt is abrogated by that construction. The only people then that would be eligible for that realistically, it would be people who took their 400-foot, square foot, or less unit and put it on a campground they didn't own, an RV campground. Typically, RV campgrounds, as you know, have utilities. You hook up to electricity, you hook up to water, you hook up to all those things. And in all cases, you screw down a jack or push some stabilizer into this thing because the wind can come up while you're in the campground. The only difference would be the unit owner wouldn't be on his own land. He wouldn't be paying real estate taxes in Wisconsin. He would simply be a visitor, and he'd be paying rent to somebody else. And I don't think that's what the legislature intended. And I don't think they really intended to have a unit of this size sitting out there with no utilities, with no electricity. They're designed to be lived in. They're specifically stated to be at least part-time or seasonal residences. Well, I think that in order to give full credit to what the legislature must have intended, they must have intended somebody to take advantage of the exemption and not just people who don't own real estate in Wisconsin. A if there are other questions, I think what I would do would be to just go back to what I was going to say about why these things are not real estate. Draw upon what Judge Dykeman said and just point out that the statute he refers to, the town argues, was not designed to deal with whether these are connections to real estate or not, and we grant that. But they do, that statute does govern the construction of these units. They have to have at least 35 pounds of tongue weight. If the tongue is on the ground, it's not real, it's real estate, according to the majority opinion. If the tongue's off the ground, pulled by a vehicle, then it's not real estate, because all the weight's on the wheels, so it's off its wheels, according to the literal language of the majority opinion. Same thing would be true. The town and we agree on one thing, and that is I think that the focus should be on the nexus between the unit and the ground. There should be a focus on the connection between the two. Whether it's immobile or whether it's mobile. But consider, if you have 35 pounds tongue weight, you put the tongue down, it's going to be considered to be real estate, a real property improvement. However, if you have the tongue down, it's on the ground, it's more mobile. The only way you can solve that would be to take the tongue off the unit completely. Now all the weight would be on the wheels, but it would be less mobile. We think that that's an absurd result.
Well, what's Judge Dykeman has some very colorful language about how the result of the majority is that if you went to the bathroom at night, you tipped the trailer. What does that all mean?
He's saying the reason you put stabilizers under it is because if you were going to wake up in the middle of the night, you might find it somewhat unsteady, and you might be sliding one way or the other, depending upon whether the wind was blowing or not.
That's all he means?
Well, that's as far as I can imagine.
So what are you saying, that any time you have a trailer that you're going to park for any length of time, that you got to do more than have it on its wheels? Because it's otherwise it's not stable?
Of up to 400 square feet is still not a camper with a pop-up. Those are specifically recognized in the exemption statute, too, but so are these. And with these, they use a screw jack to screw it down, hold it in place temporarily, put these cinder blocks, slide blocks in there to keep it stabilized, keep the wheels are on the ground. But yes, most of them do have some form of stabilizer. It's been stipulated, too, that virtually all of them, in this case, do have a stabilizer, but it's a temporary, movable stabilizer. It's not a permanent fixture to the ground. I think another thing that you have to keep in mind, I'd like you to keep in mind, is that this statute affects everybody in the state of Wisconsin, not just people who live in an RV park such as my clients. If a man who lives up north on 100 acres of land has a farm, has a home, and he has an RV, and he takes it out and he puts it behind the house, and Aunt Martha comes to visit, so he sticks a cord out the window so there's some electricity in it. You might even have some water there available. She comes to visit more often than once or twice. Takes the tongue and puts it on the ground. She stays in it for 2 nights. It's considered an improvement to real property. Even though the next day he takes it and pulls it to Arizona. But it's considered under the majority test to be an improvement to real property. We think that that's a sort of result.
Yes. You use the term recreational vehicle. I think of recreational vehicle as a Winnebago, you know, that where the driving unit is part of the living unit. Does that fall within the definition of mobile home?
It's a term of art, not a term of law. You're correct. I mean, I think of a recreational vehicle, and my clients think of them as being these units that we're talking about. But I also think of a Winnebago as being a recreational vehicle.
Well, I guess my point is you suggested a recreation vehicle is a mobile home, and I'm just wondering if that kind of Winnebago is a mobile home for the legal definition of mobile home in this case.
It could well be, as long as it's designed for living purposes, was or is originally developed. But
I need help. 66.0433 wrong, 66.0435, I thought defined mobile home. And it defined mobile home in part as that which is or was as originally constructed designed to be transported by any motor vehicle.
You're correct, Jack. In that case, it wouldn't be. Sure, used by the statute's recreational mobile home, my clients perhaps inartfully call it a recreational vehicle.
Now, counsel, didn't you say, and maybe so, you said that 20 or so of these were, had their own motor, so I was envisioning exactly like a Winnebago or something like that.
Some of the units that are in the park actually are travel trailers. They actually have their own motor in them. The majority of those that we're talking about today, however, do not, but they meet the definition of mobile home, which Justice just noted. And by time, I see that I've come down to the discussion.
Until your red light goes on, so you've got about 4 more minutes, counsel.
One of the areas that concerned me was this, in the opinion, and I just, is this interchangeability between taxes, real property, maybe that's wrong, but same mill rate, tax it as personal property. Can you help me? What's the difference? Why? I mean, there's some appeal to that, you know, simplicity.
There's an appealing argument, and I guess if you have a recreational mobile home larger than 400 square feet, and if indeed the assessor does his job and taxes it exactly the way it should be taxed, then there may be no difference at all. Because whether it's off or on its wheels, it's going to be considered real or personal property subject to the same rate of tax. And as long as it's properly taxed, there wouldn't be any difference in the actual tax dollar. There would still be these other differences I pointed out between the type, you know, the reason you classify property.
Well, you suggested in your brief that it's fair market value, but it can be determined differently for different uses.
We did submit that, and I still maintain that that's quite possibly the case because of the way the action process works. Personal property in Wisconsin is taxed by having the assessor send to the owner a form and say, tell us what your personal property is worth, and then indicate what its depreciation is, and then send it back to us. Now, and to draw a parallel, which you've probably dealt with in an office furniture, you may have a desk. After 5 years, the desk is valueless, except that it's still there and being used, and no longer then subject to practical personal property tax. But I don't know of any houses, I don't know of any real estate, which are actually considered the home itself, the improvements that real estate ever reached the point of zero. So as it's practically enforced as opposed to in theory, I believe there is a distinction, but that, in theory, is not the case. In theory, they should be the same. The last thing I want to say is, I guess we can't reach my red light. Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. Robert Horowitz, representing the town of Fulton.
May it please the court, I'm Robert Horowitz. I represent the town of Fulton. What difference would it have made if the assessor had done it their way? Almost none. The tax would have been exactly the same. We know that from the undisputed affidavit of the assessor, and we know that as a matter of law because real property and personal property must both be taxed at fair market value. Would it have made any difference to the question of whether the property is exempt? Well, the plaintiffs pleaded in their complaints, in paragraph 6 of each of their complaints, that their mobile homes were exempt personal property. And now they tell us on page 5 of their reply brief that this issue, I'm quoting, is not properly before the court. So the plaintiffs have, in effect, abandoned their claim that all their mobile homes are tax-exempt. And they tell you now that they want to go and make that claim to the Board of Review, yet the Board of Review, under Section 70.47, has absolutely no authority to determine an exemption. An exemption is determined by the assessor and not by the Board of Review. they are not challenging the amount of the assessment because they never did go to the Board of Review. Now, the plaintiffs would have received two tax bills instead of one, a real property tax bill for the land and, under the Court of Appeals decision, for the freestanding structures, and a personal property tax bill for the mobile home, still assuming that the assessor had done it their way. Here's where we get to the only practical difference for the plaintiffs. The tax on real property can be paid in two installments, one on due January 31, the next due July 31. The tax on personal property must be paid in full by January 31. So the only practical difference for the plaintiffs here in the classification between real property and personal property is that if the mobile homes had been classified as personal property, they would have had to pay that part of the tax sooner. Now, there are administrative differences concerning the collection of unpaid taxes, but those aren't relevant here either, because all these taxes were paid on time. So what's all the fuss about? Why are the plaintiffs fighting so hard to convince you that these homes should have been classified as personal property tax and not real property tax? It's part of a clever way they've thought up to avoid paying any tax at all without ever having to prove that any of their mobile homes qualify to be exempt personal property tax. Because their theory is that if the tax is imposed as real property, and it turns out that the mobile home, after you construe this ambiguous statute, was personal property, then it's an unlawful tax. They don't have to pay that tax at all. And what they don't tell you is that it's too late for the assessor to go back and tax these mobile homes as personal property, because the assessor has only 2 years to do that. And these taxes involved before you today involved 1995, 1996, and 1997.
I know, but that's a short-term win.
Pardon me?
It's a short-term win, because if you're right, okay, they may have gotten out of taxes for those years, but in the future years, they'll be taxed as personal property.
That is correct. But it is what is at stake in this case before you today. So eventually, it makes no difference at all whether these homes are taxable as real property or personal property, unless the plaintiffs can prove that their homes are tax exempt, and they've told you that that issue, even though they pleaded it in their complaint, is not before the court today.
Counsel, as I mentioned before, this kind of, we may be taxed it as real property, and maybe it's a personal property, but what's the difference? Same thing, no harm, no foul kind of thing. And you're suggesting in your comments, well, the only practical difference is they have to pay sooner rather than later in terms of the installments. Is it your position that if this were inverted, that for some reason that it was assessed as personal property, and a court of appeals said, well, it's not personal property, but they would have to pay it the same amount if it were going to be real property, and so we'll just say they have to pay the taxes for the real property. Does it work both ways?
Yes, that's exactly my position. But the plaintiffs have the opposite position. If the assessor had assessed these mobile homes as personal property, I'm sure the plaintiffs would be here today telling you they were real property so that they wouldn't have to pay the tax.
I'll tell you the thing that concerns me, and it's the old maxim of, you know, we don't decide this case just for the parties, but for establishing the law in the state of Wisconsin. And looking at the property tax guide for Wisconsin mobile home owners, it says, question, are you familiar with this?
Yes.
I don't want to ask you something.
and question, and as you know, the format is a number of questions and answers, and this is a publication by the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. Will I be notified if there is a change in my assessment? And the answer indicates that if you're assessed as real property, under the statutes, there's a notice provision that has to be followed. In other words, the taxing authority has to notify you, and I can go, the notice must be in writing and mailed at least 15 days prior to the Board of Review meeting, etc., etc. There's a procedure. But it says the notice requirement does not apply to personal property assessed under Chapter 70.
You can still, if you have personal property, you can still challenge the assessment if you believe the assessment is too high.
I know you can still challenge it, but I'm trying to figure out what's the difference. You know, same old, same old. And it seems to me that the notice requirements are different. That is, if the municipality wants to increase your tax, this question-answer thing says they have to notify you. It has to be with 15 days and in writing, and there's some other stuff that follows that. But if they want to increase your personal property tax, there is no notice required. So it seems like that's a difference. If you find out that they're doing it, then you can contest it to the Board of Review.
And you find out they're doing it when you get your personal property tax bill, and then there is an opportunity to contest it. And there are several ways to contest it. One of them, for example, is the type of lawsuit that was brought here, a claim for excessive assessment. Now, the basic problem with this lawsuit, which is a claim for excessive assessment, is that there was no excessive assessment. The assessment was exactly right.
Is there any other, now I've highlighted one difference in the notice procedure. It makes a difference in terms of you're going to be notified for increases, whether or not your property is taxed as personal or real. Are there any other differences other than the notice procedures and the payment procedure?
Well, there are differences that are not relevant to this case. For example, if there are differences in the methods that can be used to collect delinquent personal property taxes, for example, whether it's real property or personal property, there can be a personal lawsuit against the owner to collect the taxes. But if it's real property, there's also a procedure for issuing a tax certificate and ultimately taking a tax deed, or alternatively foreclosing on the tax certificate in the manner of a mortgage. But none of these procedural differences have the remotest relevance to these plaintiffs. The only thing these plaintiffs care about is that they want this court to say that the assessor made the wrong choice between real property and personal property, and that that amounts to an unlawful tax, which means they don't have to pay it.
Well, what's your position? Is your position that this is, your position may be, Fulton, you want your money, and you don't care whether it's real or personal, but you ought to get it here. But now, next year's another tax year for the town of Fulton, then thereafter. So what is your position? Is this, how do you define real property? How do you define personal property?
Our position is essentially the Court of Appeals position, that you define, not essentially, it's exactly the Court of Appeals position, that you define real property exactly the way the Court of Appeals defined it. And which is that if any of the weight is off the wheels and is on some other support, then it is real property. In other words, our position...
Does that include the tongue?
When this mobile home is delivered to the park, it's no longer attached to the vehicle that's transporting it. All the stuff in Judge Dykeman's opinion about the tongue weight is from a statute that only applies to mobile homes that are being pulled on the highway. It's just, Judge Dykeman just got the wrong chapter a chapter that doesn't have anything to do with this case.
So what you would be saying, and I'm just trying to, once it's unhooked from the truck or the vehicle, it's brought in and placed on the lot, and in this case it's owned by the owners, once that is done, it goes from personal property to real property.
If some of the weight is supported by something other than the wheels. Now, of the night...
Now, let me ask, I'm thinking about the... you'll have to help me, but many mobile homes, not smaller ones, don't they have kind of a thing that comes down on each corner to kind of stabilize it a little so it doesn't blow around?
Well, Adam, in these mobile homes, the record shows that one of the mobile homes, the one owned by the Bowers, rests 100% on its wheels. The others have some form of a stabilizer. They not only do they...
Like an iron rod or something that...
They have blocks. What the record shows is they have blocks, jacks, permanent footings. They're also attached to sunrooms, patio rooms, porches, decks, sheds. These are not things that are going to get up the next minute and travel to Florida. These are here to stay.
But according to the record, in 2 or 3 hours, they could be traveling. Is that right or wrong?
Yeah, they could be, but they've acquired the characteristics of real property. And that is one of the two legislative purposes behind classifying, drawing the line between real property and personal property. They've acquired the characteristics of real property. And remember, we have to look at them as they are on the assessment date, January 1. They could be moved, but they weren't being moved on January 1.
How could a mobile home, and I think of a mobile home as having, not wheels on each corner like an automobile does, but rather wheels that are together like that and then the tongue in the front. How can that ever be resting completely on its wheels without being totally topsy-turvy?
Well, the record, all I can do is cite to the record. That's all I'm committed to doing.
My common sense. I mean, if these wheels are in the middle of the mobile hub, and there's only, two of them or two sets of two, and then you've got a tongue at one end, unless some of either the tongue or something else is supporting it, that mobile home is going like this when you walk it. That's why Judge Doten is afraid to be in one himself in the middle of the night.
Well, we have to be limited by the record. The plaintiffs never made that argument. They offered no evidence that that was the case. And the stipulation is that the Bowers home is supported completely by the wheels, and there's nothing to suggest that they go topsy-turvy in the middle of the night when they go to the bathroom.
Well, but, I mean, we can take judicial notice of that. I mean, that's in fact, I don't think we even need to take judicial notice of that fact. If we have an object that is 10 by 40 and it only has two wheels in the middle of it, in order for it to... to one end or the other, like a teeter-totter, it's got to be supported by something else.
Well, Judge Bachman thought so, but there's absolutely nothing in the record to support.
Well, I know there may not be anything in the record, but I know what I know.
But do they all only have two wheels? Do they only have two wheels or...
The record does not say that these are supported only by two wheels.
Are there any mobile homes that have four?
The record only says which homes are supported only by the wheels, and that's the Bowers home out of 20, and the rest are supported in part by something else. So our position is that if they are supported in whole or in part by something else, then they should be classified as real property because they've taken on the characteristics of real property.
If you accept my assumption, even if it's not on the record, but let's assume that there's two, you can, a mobile home then can never be personal property. And the legislature obviously has provided for a personal property exemption.
Well,
how do you answer that?
The Bowers home is supported only by its wheels.
How many wheels does it have?
It doesn't say in the record how many wheels it has, but it says that it's supported only by its wheels.
Was it your position that that's personal property? Bauer?
Yes.
And that's what the Court of Appeals said, and that is the home that the Court of Appeals conducted the extensive analysis of whether it was exempt personal property or not exempt personal property.
Well, this is what is maybe perplexing to other justices, but I'm not that familiar with mobile homes. But if at the time the tax assessor, and you said January 1st, well, I doubt very much that on January 1st the tax assessor was out to this property, because he was out there someday, he or she, at some time. But that's true. If a mobile home, which you pull behind some vehicle, is parked somewhere and the assessor sees it, and at that time, it is other than on its own, it has its own wheels, but the vehicle is departed, then it takes on a characteristic of real property. That seems to be your argument.
That's correct.
Here, I understand this is a park and people own the lots and come in.
Well, it's not just that it's resting on something else. The owner owns the lot, it's connected to utilities, and it's not just attached to a stabilizer. There are sunrooms, patios, porches, decks. These are the kinds of things that have taken on the character of real property. And that's exactly what the legislature had in mind in drawing the line between real property and personal property.
Counsel, bear with me for a moment. Let's assume that we turn this table upside down, so it's a flat surface, and then we attach axles on it in the middle of the table, and we put a wheel on each axle, on each side of that axle. Now, the law of physics tells me that if I should even put a finger on that end, assuming that it's perfectly in the middle, that end is going to go down. Or vice versa. And if I put the wheels over here instead of in the middle, then that end is going to be touching the ground. The only way that I can get it to be on all four wheels is to have wheels on each corner. Now, you say the record doesn't contain that, but we haven't repealed the law of physics.
Well, if there were four wheels on it, it wouldn't tip at all.
That's right. Then it's on its wheels.
It is on its wheels, and if it's only on its wheels, then it's personal property. But it's not necessarily exempt personal property, because if the mobile home on its wheels is attached to other things which exceed 400 feet, including the mobile home and the attachments, then under the Court of Appeals decision, it's not exempt. It's personal property, but it's not exempt. Now, one thing we should keep in mind here, the line between real property and personal property is the gateway to an exemption. It has to be personal property to be exempt. The plaintiffs say you should construe this statute in the taxpayer's favor, but this amounts to construing an exemption statute. So if there's a doubt about it, if things are... If they might borrow that image, the rule that you should construe taxing statutes in favor of the taxpayer, but exemption statutes against the taxpayer is a weight in favor of the Court of Appeals argument.
Counsel, I want to ask you one of the questions I asked your opposing counsel, just to make sure that I have it straight. Is it your position that the above or below 400 square feet discussion only belongs in the context of an exemption for personal property and does not belong in the analysis of what constitutes real property?
Correct.
Didn't the Court of Appeals kind of mix it? I thought that when I was reading it,
I don't think so. I read the Court of Appeals opinion many times, and I didn't notice that they were mixing it up. The only
I look at paragraph 21.
second sentence is what caused me some concern.
This section, paragraph 21, is in the context of the question of whether the... I can explain. This is in the context of what constitutes an unlawful tax. Now, the plaintiff's theory is that this is an unlawful tax because the property was misclassified. What the Court of Appeals is saying is that the statute, section 74.33, defines what an unlawful tax is. It can be one of six things. One of them is that it's exempt from taxation. The plaintiffs disclaim any reliance on that. Instead, the plaintiffs rely on a different part, a different one of the six, the one that says the property, the real property, did not exist as of the assessment date.
So and, B.
Yes, and the Court of Appeals' answer to that is this property existed. The only question is whether it was real property or personal property. So that doesn't make it an unlawful tax. So
their argument is that it did not exist as real property.
That is correct, but the purpose of that provision of the statute is not to provide a way of challenging the classification of the property as real property or personal property. The purpose of that statute is to deal with property that is under construction as of January 1. For example, a building that is being built as of January 1 can only be assessed for the portion that is completed as of January 1. And if the assessor visits the building on, you know, March 1, and it's all done, the assessor can't assess it on the value of the whole building, but only on what's what was completed on January 1.
Their response is, as I said, you just see it differently.
They see it differently. They think that that statute was designed to say that a misclassification alone makes it an unlawful tax. But even if they're right, it doesn't get them anywhere, because we then get to 74.39, which says that that the plaintiffs can win only if they paid more tax than was due. Well, the very thing that the plaintiffs have admitted at the beginning of the oral argument today and earlier in this case is the tax is the same. So even if the plaintiffs get through most of their argument with success, even if they convince you that their construction of the statute is correct, that it's really personal property, even if they convince you that a misclassification as real property is an unlawful tax, still, the only thing they can get is the excessive tax they paid. But they didn't pay any excessive tax. They paid to the penny exactly the amount of tax that was due. So they can't recover under Section 74.35, which is the claim for an excessive assessment. The assessment was exactly right.
Now, do you agree with the conclusion of the Court of Appeals, namely that they remand with respect to non-representative owners to see if the basic unit rests wholly on its wheels, thus qualifying it as personal property, and then to see if it's exempt under that provision? Do you agree with that?
No. The trial court decided the case based on the representative plaintiffs. There was an opportunity for the other plaintiffs to offer evidence that their homes qualified for exemption, and none of them did.
So you don't totally agree with the Court of Appeals decision?
Correct. In that respect, I disagree with the Court of Appeals decision and do not think that there's any need to remand the case for additional evidence about the non-representative plaintiffs.
Would just hold they're all taxable.
Yes. And one reason I would hold that they're all taxable is that there's no dispute that has been raised by the evidence that any of them qualify as exempt personal property. They had that opportunity, and they didn't use that opportunity.
And I was looking at your conclusion, too. The Court of Appeals' decision will be affirmed in part and reversed in part with instructions to dismiss all claims. Right? What are you affirming and what are you reversing?
The only parts that I disagree with the Court of Appeals are the one we've just been discussing, and the part of the Court of Appeals decision that says, in measuring the 400 square feet, the Court of Appeals says you only count things that are physically attached to the mobile home. But we think it should be somewhat broader and count structures that belong to the mobile home. This is a fine point of distinction between our position and the position of the Court of Appeals.
Get to that. If it's real estate, you don't have to get to it. If it's real property, we don't have to get to the 400 square feet because that's only applicable to personal property.
Correct. If you conclude that a mobile home is real property, then you never get to the issue of 400 square feet. That's right.
And your position is the Court of Appeals should have never gotten there.
Our position is that the Court of Appeals our position is that with one of the 20 representative plaintiffs, the Court of Appeals concluded that on its definition, dividing real and personal property, that one home, the Bowers home, was personal property. And so the Court of Appeals properly went into the analysis of whether that particular home was personal property and concluded that it was not, because counting the home and the attachments, which is the Court of Appeals test, the home plus attachments exceeded 400 square feet, so it was not exempt. So that disposed of number 20. 1 through 19 had already been disposed of by the Court of Appeals as real property under the Court of Appeals test.
I'm not completely clear. If the court were to determine that this was personal property, what do we do at that point? How do we deal with the exemption? Or are you saying that we don't deal with the exemption?
I'm saying that there's, let me put it this way. The court may want to construe the statute dividing real property and personal property, and if so, it would need to apply that construction to the representative plaintiffs. But I'm saying that the court doesn't even have to do that, because the real issue in this case, the fundamental issue, is whether the plaintiffs paid an excessive tax. If they didn't pay an excessive tax, that's the end of the story. This court doesn't even have to decide the fine points of the construction of the statute about real property and personal property. It can leave the Court of Appeals construction standing in its published opinion.
I'm just not getting this. I can understand that argument. If it's real property or personal property and it's subject to tax, I completely agree with you.
Right.
But if it's exempt, what do we do with the exemption?
Well, the Court of Appeals on the one representative plaintiff that the Court of Appeals found was personal property, the Court of Appeals analysis demonstrated that that was taxable and not exempt. So your question relates to what about the non-representative plaintiffs, and really goes to the disposition of the case. Should the non-representative plaintiffs be given another chance to come forward with evidence that they qualify as exempt personal property? And the Court of Appeals thought they should, and we think they had that chance, and therefore there's no need to give them a second kick at the cat. That's the difference.
Counsel, I am bothered by the same thing that apparently bothers Justice Bablich. That's the law of physics. And I'm bothered because the majority opinion is contrary, just like Justice Babbage was describing the law of physics, that there has to be something to support it, otherwise it'll be what we say cattywampus, you know. So your response is, well, there's this one that was Bowers that was situated on all of its wheels. But the Court of Appeals opinion in describing that says, we next consider the application of the statute to one mobile home described in the record as having no support for the basic unit other than its wheels. And so there you go. But it was attached by caulking to a substantial screen room and porch which sits on footings. So that's why you have the law of physics at work for that Bauer house, because it was caulked to something else that was by footing. So that was secured by footing. So yes, I'd love to embrace, well, I'd love to, but I mean, I would think, sure, let me embrace the Court of Appeals majority opinion, by holding that if any weight is on something other than the wheels, and my knowledge, and I don't want to, my knowledge would be that unless you violate the law of physics, some weight, whether it's caulked to something else or has a little thing you screw up, some weight has to be on something else, that under the Court of Appeals majority opinion, it's all going to be
not if there are four wheels.
Four wheels in a mobile home that is defined as being pulled behind something. So that's the kind of mobile home we're talking about. We're not talking about an RV that you sit up in front. Are we? Maybe I'm wrong.
We're not talking about that. We're talking about mobile homes that are not connected to vehicles that are pulling them. These are detached.
Yeah, but are made to be pulled. I thought that was part of the definition of mobile homes.
They're made to be pulled so they can get to the location they're in.
That's right.
But once they're in that location, they're there.
You take the vehicle and you take that tongue, you take the hitch, you take it off the hitch of the truck, and you take that tongue that went onto the hitch, and you do something with that tongue. And what you do is you support it on something.
Well, you could, but the Bowers didn't do that.
Well, no, the Bowers caulked the darn thing to a screen
that,
porch.
That is correct.
Also, hypothetically, then, under this, your proposal, I'm just saying, I could have three lots. I could have one mobile home. And I could pull that mobile home, and I could be there 3 months out of the year, 3 months out of the year, and 3 months out of the year. And if I had bad luck, and it's the town of Fulton in one case, and it's the town of Dakota in the other, and the town of Saratoga in the next, I could have three assessments on that mobile home if it was there at the wrong time of the year when the assessor came. No. Why is that? Because it's
personal property is assessed as of January 1.
But the point is, nobody assesses it on that day. It's when the assessor comes around. That's what I'm saying.
That's right. But if the mobile home wasn't there on January 1, the assessor wouldn't assess it. Well, and if the assessor did assess it, the owner would say, well, this mobile home wasn't there on January 1.
But it could. What I'm saying is that it could be, if you had three lots, you could pull the same mobile home and place it on those lots and use it for a period of time. And hypothetically, it could be.
Well, the assessor can only assess it once. But regardless of how you construe the statute, these plaintiffs didn't pay an excessive tax because they haven't shown that they have exempt mobile homes.
Counsel, I'm still back to your conclusion. I'm going to do the second sentence. In the alternative, the court should adopt the town's interpretation of the various statutes and reject the owner's claim that he's subject to unlawful or unconstitutional tax. What does that mean?
What that means is, regardless of how you construe the dividing line between real property and personal property, there was no unlawful tax here. because it doesn't meet any of the six criteria of Section 74.33, and there was no excessive tax because the tax is exactly the same. So no matter how you construe the statute, even if you agree with Judge Dyckman about the laws of physics and conclude that the Court of Appeals misconstrued the statute, the plaintiffs still lose because they didn't pay any more tax than they under one way as under the other way.
But under that alternative, you'd send it back on remand for further proceedings. What kind of proceedings?
I don't think it would be necessary to send it back because none of the plaintiffs have offered any evidence that they have exempt mobile homes. However, if you conclude that they should be given another opportunity to show that they have exempt mobile homes, then you would send it back for that, but only for that purpose.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument. Mr. Devitt, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I thought I knew that what we were claiming better than I did. Evidently, I didn't. We are indeed claiming that there was excessive taxation. We claimed it consistently from the circuit court on. What we said was the tax rate might be the same. We've paid too much. We paid too much because our units are not real property. Our units are not improvements. They're exempt. We just haven't been taxed as personal property, so we haven't had the chance to come forward to set that forth. Tax assessment manual sets forth specific procedures. It says if you're taxed as real property, you get a real property assessment. If you're taxed as personal property, you get a real personal property assessment form. You then have to file an objection within 48 hours prior to the hearing. You can't object on a real property assessment form that your property is personal property. All you can object on it is that it's valued too highly. You can't do that because then it's an excessive assessment case. That's why it's an unlawful tax case. We're not saying that the assessment of appropriate real property is too high. We're saying we've never had a chance to come in and seek the exemption that the statute grants us. Of course the tax is excessive. We've also never said that the real property component of the tax is wrong. We haven't said we want every dollar that we've had to pay in tax every year on what we dispute back. We have filed claims every year as we're required to. Each one of those claims identifies improvements to the real property only that we consider to be a recreational vehicle. That's what we've said is illegal. And we have never claimed that these are not exempt. We claim exactly the opposite. But we can't, in the course of a lawsuit that's dealing with nothing but improvements to real property, the way that that's been defined, we can't claim a personal property tax exemption because we haven't been taxed as personal property. So that is, unfortunately, that's the case. Or fortunately, it's the case. And then there's the issue of what about those other units? How many of those representative plaintiffs are really exempt personal property? The majority, even the majority test, indicates that freestanding structures are not part of the 400 square feet. Nine of the 20 representative plaintiffs, nine of the 20, have less than 400 square foot trailers, and they have freestanding structures on their lot. Freestanding structures that are appropriately taxed as real property because they are improvements, but they also have an RV, and that RV is not an improvement to real property. It is exempt personal property. If they ever had the chance to come forward and object to personal property, if they ever had notice of a personal property tax, they would have come forward and pointed out how it's not attached to anything, how it does not fit within the 400, it's not excessive, it's not above 400 square feet, how it's seasonal. We just haven't been taxed that way. That's what makes this a due process case. We've never had notice, as in the town of McKesson, the United States Supreme Court case indicates that since we haven't had notice, there has to be a clear and appropriate remedy. What's the remedy? The only remedy that's available is to refund the unlawful portion of the tax.
After you lost in the trial court, did you lose there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we won the first half and then decided that it was personal property that wasn't exempt. That's why we appealed.
You didn't go back to the assessor and try to prove that it was exempt, did you?
We have every year filed claims. Every year we've told the town we think that it's unlawful to tax us as real property. As clear as day. They know if they could have taxed us as personal property. And really, if the town's position is, hey, there's no difference between real property and personal property, why didn't they tax us as personal property? Why didn't they give us the chance to come in and ask for the exemption that 71.1.119 provides us? Because there would have been no harm. If they would have done it that way, we would at least have been given the right to seek the exemption. But it's curious that they didn't. They taxed us only as real property, thus denying us the right to come in and to request the exemption. Final point, council says there's no difference between real property, personal property tax. We contend that there is a difference. A lot of this case is about 7043. You know the legislature changed it in 1983. You know, and you've been told by both sides, the reason they did it is so to make it easier for the assessor to distinguish between real property and personal property. If that's the case, how can there be no difference between them? Who's trying to make it easier to make the distinction? There must have been a purpose in mind for the distinction. And there is. Certain people can claim certain personal property exemptions. My clients have been denied, thus far, the right to do so. Thank you.
Thank you,
could I ask one question?
Mr. Prosser.
The majority opinion in the Court of Appeals says most of the owners reside in their homes 2 to 7 months of the year. Is that correct?
There are varying times, some 2, some 3, some 4, up to 7, but certainly they're seasonal, yes. Some aren't, by the way.
Is there any implication from that that the mobile homes move when they're not residing there?
Not from that.
I mean, do
they? May, they may not.
I mean, is there anything in the record that says whether these homes move?
No.
No. There's nothing in the record.
There's nothing
in
the record.
Well, that goes to whether it's exempt because it's seasonal. Is that the point?
That's correct. That's correct, Justice.
Thank you. Any other questions? If there are none, that concludes the hearing on 99-2466, Aarons versus Town of Fulton. Thank you, Mr.